he never sought fame.
No one has ever equaled his sound or technique.
He never showed his work to anyone but his friends.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, what is an artist's artist?
The person who I would consider an artist's artist would be without a doubt Billie Holiday. She was able to deliver a certain level of emotional immediacy to any recording.
Artists like Branford Marsalis reveal their heroes and explain what makes those artists so inspirational.
There are very few people in jazz history who understand the essence of the message. She understood the essence of the message, absorbed it, and enhanced it.
That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. Public radio is supposed to be broadcasting's designated kitsch-free zone. But if you're like me, you don't hate all kitsch. It depends how you define it. There's kitsch as defined by Merriam-Webster, quote, something that appeals to popular or lowbrow taste. According to that definition, I'm a kitsch aficionado. I like some TV game shows, for instance, and Howard Stern, Burger King Double Whoppers with Cheese, Las Vegas, and Led Zeppelin songs.
You need cooling, baby, I'm not fooling.
But then there's kitsch as the American Heritage Dictionary defines it. Quote, sentimentality or pretentious bad taste, especially in the arts. This is where kitsch gets more problematic. Sure, every September I do try to watch both the Jerry Lewis Telethon and the Miss America pageant.
Miss America 2002 is Miss Oregon, Katie Harmon.
Both of those more than qualify as kitsch. Sentimental, pretentious, bad taste, but they don't pretend to be the arts. It's when kitsch tries to pass as art that I find it hard to enjoy or laugh off, like Thomas Kincaid. Lately, I've developed something of an obsession with Thomas Kincaid. Thomas Kincaid is a painter, an artist, a very successful, very bad artist. You may have seen his art at one of the hundreds of Thomas Kincaid galleries around the country. His pictures are pretty much all the same, overripe American landscapes and cozy old-fashioned American houses, all bathed in golden pre-dusk light. There have never been more treacly pictures of inanimate objects. And they're not even very well painted. But every year, Kincaid sells more than $100 million worth of this stuff. Some of his customers have their reproductions customized by one of Kincaid's itinerant master highlighters. The highlighters brush on a few strokes of real paint, thus transforming an overpriced mass-produced print into, quote, a unique work of art. Kincaid's corporate blurbs call him America's foremost living artist and the most commercially successful and collected living artist in U.S. history. But what really makes him appalling is how he pitches himself as a kind of religious prophet. Kincaid's corporate website says the business is all about, quote, his message of peace, hope, the beauty of nature, and a simpler way of life. I guess spreading that message of a simpler way of life is why he recently licensed his name to a gated development of $400,000 houses in a San Francisco suburb. And why last month he published his first novel, Cape Light, written with a co-author. Like his paintings, Thomas Kincaid's novel makes my teeth hurt. Imagine a book for 12-year-olds written by The Simpsons' insufferable goody-goody neighbor, Ned Flanders. It's that bad. As the critic Laura Miller of Salon.com said in her review, Cape Light has the blandness of foods prepared for invalids whose stomachs can't tolerate too much excitement or variety. Painting, real estate, now fiction, where will it all end? Maybe starting here and now. Cape Light is a bomb if its Amazon.com sales rank is any indication. A low, low 14,016 as of last Sunday. And Kincaid's company, the Media Arts Group, seems to be tanking too. Last year, its revenues dropped by 20%, and it's now unprofitable. For me, those are messages of hope. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Today in Design for the Real World, a form of kitsch that almost everybody's office is full of, swag. Swag is that kitschy logo-stamped freebie junk that corporate America gives away compulsively. Embossed pens and luggage sets and coasters and that public radio tote bag that's in your closet right now. American business spends billions and billions of dollars a year on this stuff. Advertising critic Warren Berger finds that some swag is much more alluring than others.
Swag is actually a slang term for plunder or booty. The business actually goes all the way back to the 1890s when a newspaper publisher named Henry Beach used his printing press to stamp his corporate logo on strips of wood. He attached a fly swatter on the end, and there you had one of the first pieces of swag. The most popular kind of swag is probably swag clothing, T-shirts, hats with company names on them. But it's also nicer apparel. If you're a VIP customer, companies may give you leather bomber jackets worth a couple of $100. I've never gotten one of those myself. Then there are also these thousands of different little objects. That's actually the kind of swag I have tons of, and I kind of like it. Little snow globes, keychains, chubby pens, paperclip holders, frisbees, little calculators. And there's weird stuff, too, that you can't even put a name on. At a trade show last year, a company gave away little plastic cars with tiny rotating brooms attached. When you roll this little car across your desk, it sweeps up the crumbs. That's a good piece of swag right there. A piece of swag is like a little billboard that lives on your desk or in your purse. The hallmark of good swag is that it's hard to throw away. It should be useful in some small way and maybe a little cute, too. You don't want to throw away a stress ball because, who knows, tomorrow you might really need it. An example of bad swag is coffee mugs. Nobody wants to get coffee mugs. Everybody has enough already. You give someone something like that, the first thing they do is look for a place where they can throw it away.
Warren Berger is the author of the book Advertising Today. Our story was produced by Amy Jeffries and Lital Molad. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it's time now for this week's cover story. Every now and then you'll hear someone say, Mary Cassatt, she was a painter's painter. Or, John Cage, he's a real composer's composer. I was galvanized by the work of Don DeLillo 25 years ago when I read his first novel, Americana, and stayed with him as he became a writer's writer for my generation. What exactly do people mean when they call somebody an artist's artist? That's what we're trying to figure out today, and to help us do it, we've asked some accomplished artists to choose their own idols and inspirations. You'll hear from them throughout the program. And to get started, here's the choreographer, Bill T. Jones.
I feel artists are oftentimes not the most successful, not the most popular, because perhaps their vision is so intense, so obsessive, that it does not lend itself to easy consumption. In terms of dance, the person who I would consider to be a choreographer's choreographer would have to be the great American choreographer Merce Cunningham. Merce has freed himself from music. He's freed himself from storyline, psychological motivation. Modern dance tried to establish long ago that it was nobody's Sleeping Beauty, that it was nobody's divertimento, or, for instance, in the opera world, when you want to show the inner life of the characters, you'll suddenly cut away and have a dance sequence. Well, modern dance has said, no, no, no. We don't illustrate some other form. We are a primary form. He started doing his works mid-20th century at a time when no one really understood what he was doing. The high modernists spoke to him in a way that most dancers could not hear because most of us were afraid of, quote, pure form.
That's Bill T. Jones on Merce Cunningham, who is still alive and kicking. Willie Nelson picked a figure from the early 20th century who revolutionized his instrument.
An artist,
yeah, would be someone that you admire and respect so much that you hope to learn something from him. When I think about the best guitar players ever, the first name that comes to my mind is Django Reinhardt. No one has ever equaled his sound or technique, and I doubt very seriously if they ever will. Every guitar player that I know knows Django. I have learned that it's possible to do anything you want to do, play anything you want to play, any way you want to play it, because there was no freer thinker, no musician that ever took chances and gambles, and I've never heard a mistake by Django. So he was one of those guys that could do it all.
Oh, yeah. I'm Kurt Anderson. In Studio 360 today, we're talking about the artists whom other artists worship. My guest is Hilton Ohls. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, where he writes about music and film and literature. Hilton, a few years ago in The New Yorker, you wrote a wonderful profile of Richard Pryor, where it was pretty clear to me that you regarded him as certainly an artist.
Yes, I do. I think that people look for easy categorizations, particularly with performers. And one of the great things about Richard, I think, is while his performance was brilliant, I think his writing and delivery was even greater.
What made him such an extraordinary breakthrough figure for so many comedians, black and white?
I think because he started literally with the word. After he decided that he would not be a second-rate Bill Cosby, he went to Oakland and sequestered himself and began to do routines in little clubs based on the street life that he saw in Oakland, which reminded him of growing up in Peoria, Illinois. But before he got to that, he would test out what a voice sounded like with a microphone by simply saying one word over and over again. It could be love or beautiful or funky or nightmare or whatever the word was, and he would try to stretch it out, shorten it, convey meaning in many different ways using one word.
So it was almost a kind of abstract version of being a comedian.
Exactly. He's the sort of Gertrude Stein of comedians, if you will. Only because.
But you think he's good.
Well, I think she's great, but Ernest Hemingway wouldn't want us to say that about her. But Richard was the first, it seems to me, modern comedian, meaning that his take on contemporary society we haven't really quite caught up with. I think that George Schlatter, who's a great producer out in Hollywood, who produced Laugh-In and discovered people like Lily Tomlin, said it best when he said, before Richard, people were only funny above the waist. And after Richard, people were funny below the waist. On the Chitlin circuit, there had been people like Red Fox and Moms Mabley and Skillet and Leroy and so on, who talked about sex and sexuality in a way that I think Richard borrowed from, but Richard made it hip only because he talked about it in terms of contemporary relationships, so that he would dovetail comments about a white woman's sexuality with the feminist movement, or he would talk about the way that black women fought back or considered themselves, you know, at least the physical equal of the man in relation to the changes that they had gone through as domestics and fetish objects, really. So I think that what he was very clever at, like Sly Stone, I think, in Sly and the Family Stone, was to have soul be the baseline, but have the lyrics be countercultural.
You're a writer. In your field, do you have somebody you regard as your kind of emblematic writer's writer?
Essayists, there are many people. In fiction, I think that it would be Jane Bowles, the novelist, short story writer, and playwright.
Who wrote very briefly.
She had a stroke when she was about in her early 40s, and she had stopped writing pretty much by then. She produced relatively little, but what she produced was of such a high quality. And again, I think I'd have to agree with Bill T. Jones, where it's not really for mass consumption, that you find it and you find, I think, your voice through certain writers by reading, as you talked about earlier, Don DeLillo and so on. I think that I found the courage to be idiosyncratic in a popular form like a magazine through reading people like Jane Bowles.
What is it about her and her writing that you so intensely admire or envy?
Well, I think envy is an interesting word, because envy should inspire you in a good way to sort of match the quality of your heroes and so on. And I think that one of the fantastic things Jane Bowles does better than anyone is to subvert, like Richard Pryor does, our traditional notions of what a woman, particularly a female character, should or should not do. She doesn't play out traditional female roles. In fact, men play very little importance in her writing, and it's the relationships between the women that are the richest and the most extraordinary. Just as I feel that Richard Pryor, his best routines are almost always about his identification with women, white and black.
The idea of a writer's writer or a filmmaker's filmmaker is a phrase that can also be used negatively or mm-hmm. patronizingly.
Mm-hmm.
Is that inevitable, that it can be this sort of faint praise for somebody who isn't very successful, like Jane Bowles?
I think that people who are afraid of real writing, afraid of Jane Bowles, afraid of Richard Pryor, have a tendency to want to diminish their achievement by saying, well, I can't get into it, it's too hermetic, or it's too different from the way that I grew up or viewed relationships. I think that one of the great things about them is that they inspire fear in their listeners and readers, and that fear generally in my life has often prompted me to think harder and want to work harder to understand what it is I'm afraid of.
I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with the writer Hilton Alls. In a minute, we'll hear from a composer who has built a career on what she calls deep listening. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. My guest today is the writer Hilton Alls, and we're talking about artists who inspire other artists. The stylish photographer Sheila Metzner has chosen Erin Rose as her role model. Erin Rose makes long exposure photographs with a lensless pinhole camera. His soft focus prints of shards of glass, constellations, and city skylines all tend to show subtle variations in the quality of light over time.
I think it's important to know that Erin was, relatively speaking, a hermit, a kind of recluse. He never sought fame. He never sold his work for money. He never showed his work to anyone but his closest, most intimate friends. But he did keep the company of people like Richard Avedon and Hero and Melvin Sokolsky. They knew his work and they loved his work and were probably very inspired by it, and even went to him for advice, sometimes technical advice, because Aaron was an inventor as well as a photographer. I think that Aaron is sort of my measure for quality in photography. If my picture isn't good enough to show to Aaron, then it isn't a good picture.
The photographer Sheila Metzner talking about the photographer Aaron Rose. Aaron Rose finally allowed his work to be shown in the Whitney Museum's biennial in 1997. The New York Times compared his images to Emily Dickinson's trove of poems hidden inside her trunk in Amherst. Hilton, what do you think about that kind of intentional obscurity? Can you imagine living that way yourself?
Yeah, because most of my close friends live that way. And I think it keeps you honest in a certain way, that the sacrifices that people who are infinitely more talented than I am and gifted and giving as artists, who are not sort of embraced by the mainstream or taken particularly seriously, I think that they're the true historians of the culture because they're on the margins of it. I think that if you're co-opted even a little bit by working at a place that is a particular brand, you have more to protect. I mean, you have an office and you have a salary.
And are the people you know whose talent to renown ratio is very high, are they people who, like Aaron Rose, whom we just heard about, who are deliberately eschewing the limelight?
I don't think so. I've seen it. I think that it really comes down to the Hollywood kind of pitch thing. It's not so much that everyone in Hollywood wants to meet you because they think you're brilliant. It's just that they want to see if they like you enough to give you the money. And I think that by and large, these are people who either they weren't socialized well as children or whatever. They are not that person that has, they don't have that particular kind of charisma. They don't do any of the politicking that you have to do. And more often than not, I think that they're very happy to not have to deal with all that stuff and to get on with their work.
Hilton Alls is my guest today in Studio 360. Our next story is about someone most of us have never heard of, but who is a big, big deal in experimental music. Pauline Oliveros has been hailed as a visionary and a renegade. She's also taught at some of the most prestigious composition programs in the country, like Mills College in Oakland. David Krasnow has this profile.
Listen. Are you listening in every possible way to everything possible to hear? This is the rudiment of something called deep listening.
Well, deep listening is not a thing, it's a process. And it's to understand that the ears transmit waves and particles to the auditory cortex eventually, and it's there where listening takes place. You can't close your ears, but you can shut off your listening. No matter how much you think you're listening, there's more to be listened to. The frog choruses in Texas in my childhood were astounding. I mean, and there you have amazing sounds, and amazing interlocking patterns of all kinds. The cicadas, all of that.
For Pauline Oliveros, the concept of deep listening encompasses the sounds of the natural world, our technological interventions in it, and the limited realm of well-ordered notes we usually call music. She was among the first Americans to create electronic music, emulating the sounds of creatures with quarter-inch magnetic tape. She helped to develop the first operational synthesizer. She's performed in water cisterns and lava caves. She broke an old taboo on improvisation in classical music, playing alongside countless musicians from different disciplines. In recent years, Oliveros has been embraced by everyone from Lincoln Center to Sonic Youth. Oh, and she plays the accordion. You haven't heard of her?
In spring, when woods are getting green, I'll try and tell you what I mean. In summer, when the
I was 20 when I left Houston. I took my accordion and $300 and went to San Francisco. I helped to found the San Francisco Tape Music Center in 1960, along with Ramon Sender and Martin Sabotnik, where we did quite a lot of new work. Sometimes I play a CD of a piece that I made 40 years ago, and there's a lot of surprise at what I was able to do with very limited means. I could generate whole pieces just with oscillators and amplifiers and tape delay.
The first time I heard one of Olivares' records, I was on the air at my college radio station. I dropped the needle and a dissonant cluster of tones began a long, steady drone. 10 seconds later, the rock DJs burst into the studio saying, "Dude, your CD's skipping."
Especially when you see it live, there's a lot that's happening that's not corresponding to what you're seeing, and so you're trying to have to stretch some to make sense of it.
I asked composer Eric Naumann why Olivares' music was not as well recognized as that of peers like Terry Riley or John Cage. He found the question sort of unproductive.
I don't know if we can find the answer in talking about accessibility, because I also wonder, you know, how many people actually sit down and listen to John Cage recordings.
I was included in a program. It was called The Eccentrics. And so I was one of the eccentrics. They did a trio of mine, which it was for violoncello and piano. And they have to invent quite a bit in that piece. And I remember the attitude of the pianist being, "Oh, we have to write your music?" I've turned the compositional process around so that I'm sharing it. I'm sharing the creative work with performers. And so you can say, "Oh, well, who's the composer?" Well, you know what? I don't care.
Olivares gave up a full professorship in California and founded the Deep Listening Space in Kingston, New York in 1985. In a storefront near the Hudson River docks, she's presented concerts and art exhibits and gathered around her a younger avant-garde that has championed her music in turn. I ran into Stephen Vitiello installing his sound exhibit at the space.
She kind of gets an instant feeling for people and what they might do and where they might go, and sometimes it's what you were after, and sometimes I get the feeling that she knows where you're going to end up.
Vitiello first encountered Olivares when they both performed at a church in Germany, souped up with a 64-channel sound system.
And I had known Pauline's music, but never really known it, and maybe never even liked it necessarily. And I walked into the church, and there was this amazing sound, and I felt like all the hairs on the back of my neck stood up, and I asked the person, what is going on? And they said, "Oh, it's just Pauline just, you know, sort of getting warmed up."
My name is Susie Ibarra, and I'm a drummer, percussionist, and composer. I met Pauline in 1996 at Mills College. I was doing a residency, and I came into one of her classes that she was teaching. Particularly that week, they were studying Bay Area women composers. It was very rare for me. It was the first time that I had ever been in a class full of women musicians studying women composers.
Olivares broke ground when she brought feminist concerns into experimental music. In 1970, 2 years after an unstable activist shot Andy Warhol, Olivares wrote a piece for her called "To Valerie Solanas and Marilyn Monroe in Recognition of Their Desperation." She penned an op-ed for the New York Times with the title, "And Don't Call Them Lady Composers."
I wrote that article probably after Morton Feldman introduced me at Max Pollock's house as this famous lady composer from California. And I said, "Hey, Morton, get off it. I don't really like that title."
Oh, I learned a great deal from Pauline, not just composition. You know, what to expect, what not to expect. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically what not to expect, and to be open in the moment about, especially in improvising.
Olivares teaches music essentially as a spiritual discipline, but it's her commitment to sound itself that sets an example.
It really didn't matter to her if a sound was going to go on for a long time. That sound was going to happen, and you had to pay attention to it for every moment that it happened, and don't worry how long it goes on. rather than thinking about needing to have a certain amount of time and fit things into that space.
I keep jumping out of the bag. You know, people think of me as this electronic composer or the improviser or this or that or the other. But why do you have to be, you know, one narrow thing? I don't want to be that. It seems like some kinds of people have to have categories and be able to grab onto that and force people into that way, that terminology or that style or that genre. And I just don't fit. Never have, probably never will.
For Studio 360, I'm David Krasnow.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today, talking with the writer Hilton Auhls. Do you find yourself in awe of people who put themselves so far out of the mainstream, even in the nature of the medium they're working in?
Yeah, in fact, I find something really sexy about it. I was turned on by listening to the story of Pauline. I'd never heard of her before, and I was particularly taken by her voice, which wasn't really the voice of resignation, but just almost a little bit of irony pushing her sentences along that I found really very compelling and beautiful, because she said that at the end of her story that she never fit and she probably never will. I think that to have the hope that one or two or 10,000 people listen to you is such a beautiful kind of hope to have, and to keep pursuing despite rejection or somebody calling you lady composer. I think it's very beautiful and it's very sexy to me.
Sexy how exactly?
Well, they're kind of iconoclastic, right? And they're on their own, and they hear the melodies or the words in their head that they hear. I often, if I'm attracted to someone's work and they're a little well known, I sort of want to get inside of their head. In fact, it spoils it for me when other people discover them, because I often feel that they're playing just for me. Like the Stettheimer sisters doing the sets for Four Saints and Three Acts. Or any number of people who have done beautiful work that doesn't get huge amounts of attention. I'm very possessive of them. I want to just have them for myself, and they fortify me.
Well, in the case of Pauline Oliveros, it reminds me that culture generally requires these obscure little sort of R&D nodes to exist. Mm-hmm. I mean, I may never go to one of these performances, but they clearly need to exist to sort of inform and color and inspire other artists in those worlds, and those ripples keep on going.
Yes, exactly. I think Jean Rhys said it once when she said that literature was this great vast ocean, and that she was so happy that her little stream went into the great vast ocean, because without the little streams there'd be no ocean. So Pauline or Merce Cunningham, any number of those people have had an extraordinary effect on the quote-unquote bigger people, like Bill T. Jones, who's more popular than Merce.
Hilton Auhls is my guest today. You're listening to Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Let's listen to some more artists choosing their favorite artist now. We'll hear from three people. First, the playwright Edward Albee, then the poet Sharon Olds, and finally, the saxophonist Branford Marsalis.
I'm Edward Albee. I write plays. When I was asked to define my ideal artist, by which in my case I guess they meant playwright, the name Samuel Beckett came to mind instantly.
Let's go.
We can't.
Why not?
We're waiting for Goddard.
Ah, yes.
Sam Beckett is an artist, because he completely reinvented drama. Drama was going along perfectly happy post-Chekhov, post-Ibsen. And all of a sudden, Beckett came along.
You're sure it was here?
What?
That we were to wait.
He sat by the tree.
But how to describe specifically how he did it is very difficult. But he showed us that there are no limits to drama, that anything is proper subject for drama, But as long as you do your task clearly and simply, anything is possible as drama.
My name is Sharon Olds, and I'm a poet. This poem by John Donne is called To His Mistress Going to Bed. Come, madam, come, all rest my powers defy. Until I labor, I in labor lie. When I think about the effect that John Donne has had on me as a writer, unpin that spangled breastplate which you wear, that the eyes of busy fools may be stopped there. And his beautiful forms on the page and his grammar. I just passionately love his grammar. License my roving hands and let them go before, behind, between, above, below. Oh, my America. And had showed me what English could do, which was quite different and more complex and more playful.
This is Branford Marcellus, and the person who I would consider an artist's artist would be without a doubt Billie Holiday.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit.
When she's singing a song like Strange Fruit, blood, you really get the sense of empathy that she feels for the victims.
And blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange from the poplar tree.
Her technique was not particularly extraordinary. As a matter of fact, it was very average. Her voice was of a very nasal quality. But like all great artists, she transcends the jazz idiom. She transcends the jazz medium. And what she was able to do, which I find most musicians are unable to do, is deliver a certain level of emotional immediacy to any recording that she worked on.
I wake and I find you asleep in the deep of my heart. Deep.
Songs that were about depression sounded so depressing that, you know, it's often said that people who were committing suicide during the Depression jumped out of the window listening to Gloomy Sunday.
My heart is telling you how much I wanted you. Gloomy Sunday.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today, talking with the New Yorker writer Hilton Alls about the artists who most inspire other artists. Hilton, we just heard Branford Marsalis talking about Billie Holiday and the song Strange Fruit. As it happens, you wrote an introduction to a book that came out a couple of years ago about that song.
Yes. I was so happy that he chose her because she would have definitely been on my top three list, along with Richard and Jane, as artists who have to inspire other artists if we're in the business of trying to understand human interaction, foibles, and need. I think Billie Holiday is the premier artist of empathy with the characters that she talks about in her songs, and I think I've learned a lot about how to develop a character on the page from listening to her sing.
Hilton Alls is my guest. I'm Kurt Anderson. Coming up, we'll meet a filmmaker who steals all of his raw material and inspires other filmmakers to steal from him. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. My guest is Hilton Auls, and we're talking about artists' artists, and now a filmmaker's filmmaker. Jay Rosenblatt has earned a big cult following for his films like Human Remains and The Smell of Burning Ants. But not many people outside the film world have any idea who Jay Rosenblatt is. Here's a look.
So what is it that we're watching?
We're watching Short of Breath. It starts off with this image of a woman. It's a frozen frame of a woman with her hands over her face and sort of a tissue. And we're hearing a loop of her crying. And it just keeps looping. And just, and this was the tricky part, was I was hoping for just when a person would say to themselves, enough already.
You say you're short of breath.
And then the way that therapist is so clued out and so insensitive, it's exactly how I feel about the world. I met Jay in 1991 at the Pesaro Film Festival in Italy, and he was showing his film Short of Breath. The metaphors were just subtle enough that they were sublime, but not so subtle that they were invisible. I felt like I'd found someone that I could really relate to. And I went up to him afterwards and just told him that I wanted to be his friend.
I think I got Short of Breath in the mail and put it in and was short of breath after I saw it. I thought it was quite extraordinary, and that was years ago.
I was impressed with the way Jay uses found footage. He was able to sort of weave it together in a way that was really sort of breathtaking, but at the same time had a very strong social and political critique.
Take a chance. Don't do it. Take a chance.
Most of his films are compilations of old health films or old education films, you know, the kind of thing that was inflicted on us in high school.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm drawn to a particular... I'm definitely drawn more towards black and white and sort of the pre-60s imagery. Just somehow that resonates with me.
Really, it's just the power of the imagery and the way he was able to kind of use this material and cut it together in a way that brings out that power. And a lot of it is in the editing and the juxtaposition of the materials.
He gets you into a very complex relation to those images.
You have to understand metaphor.
How do you and your husband get along otherwise? Do you have normal, satisfactory sexual relations?
And here you think you'd cut to her, but instead it cuts to this sort of surreal scene of a head disconnected from a body.
You know, that's a metaphor for alienation from self and from the body. And the way the head is turning to look sort of is a metaphor for the gaze of the self on the self and the distance of that.
Well, I think part of it has to do with the gulf between what you're seeing and what you're interpreting. There's a gap, and somewhere in that gap, you're sort of swept along and find a truth that you didn't expect to find in a way that you didn't expect to find it.
So this is Human Remains, and it begins with these train tracks, and then it cuts to this, what you just see the back of an old man with this young girl, and he just sort of seems like he's just touching her, she's touching him. And then all of a sudden, the face turns around and we realize it's Adolf Hitler.
I suffered from stomach cramps and eczema. I was very particular about my health and about what I ate.
In Human Remains, he dares to take you into Hitler's private life and Stalin's and Mao. And
my favorite dish was noodle soup. I loved the little dumplings.
There's this disconnect that's happening between what you know and what they're not saying, and that creates the tension of the film.
What else can I say about myself? I only had one testicle.
it's your responsibility as a viewer to make sense of that juxtaposition. What does this information that I'm hearing have to do with the images that I'm seeing on screen?
So in a way, it's a film about omission. It's what's not being said that's more important than what's being said. A new way of talking about something by not talking about it.
Im Grunde konnte ich der Natur nichts abgewinnen.
I never really enjoyed nature. I just didn't see the beauty.
Maybe it's just that Jay's a very emotional person. And actually what I like about his work, and I think this is really his greatest and most unique kind of contribution to film, is he's not afraid to feel deeply.
Jay Rosenblatt's work is just, I think it's the best kept secret in American film. I mean, in the general public, Jay Rosenblatt is not a household name, not close to it.
I think Jay's work shows for the most part on the festival circuit, and he's also shown at colleges and universities.
In other words, my films are uncommercial. Yeah.
Right, right.
Yes.
Right.
I think every artist tries to make their work as accessible as they can without diluting it or distorting it. But I think there's just certain things that are inherently subtle, and that their pleasure is in their subtlety. And to make them less subtle is to actually denature them. So I don't know that you can take a certain refined perception of something and make it accessible to a large number of people. I mean, I think what you need people to become more refined.
Along with the voice of Jay Rosenblatt, you heard the filmmaker Kaveh Zahedi, the director of film studies at Boston University, Ray Carney, and the editor of Res magazine, Holly Willis. Jonathan Mitchell produced the story, and you can find out more at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, talking with the writer Hilton Alls. Hilton, Rosenblatt is a filmmaker, apparently. His techniques, as soon as his films are released, pop up in mainstream features mm-hmm. all the time, mm-hmm. As is such a common thread with these kinds of artists,
yes.
where they get essentially appropriated by the larger world. Is that as much as a kind of worldly success as people like this can hope for, is to see what they pioneered picked up by others?
I would imagine that that's pretty annoying. I think that one of the ways that their work hopefully gets to live is it's sort of like looking at Kenneth Anger's films and seeing the huge influence that it had on Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets, the use of popular music, cutting, and so on. And one of the ways that they can be given the attention that they deserve is if the person who takes from them says, oh, that's really something that I got from Kenneth Anger. He's this blah, blah, blah filmmaker, and so pass on the legacy of these great artists to other filmmakers so that they can be inspired and learned from, and so that the filmmaker has a life outside of, you know, Martin Scorsese's head or whatever.
What about when artists are artists like Terrence Malick, mm-hmm. after he made Badlands in mm-hmm. the 1970s, or Stanley Kubrick after his extraordinary films of the late 50s and the 60s? And then one has a sense in those two cases that those artists become sort of paralyzed themselves by the obligation of being
yes.
the great artists, and their work is never quite lives up.
Well, I think that they become self-conscious because they're working in a popular art form, but they're not populist. So it's an interesting thing. It's not like Steven Soderbergh, who is a populist and wants to make films that people go to see, but, you know, wants his art, quote-unquote, to be in the films as well. I think that that's a different situation. If you have a kind of populist mind or sensibility, you're not really affected by adulation and people throwing thousands of dollars at you to make your next film. I think that Terrence Malick, in particular, is an artist working in a popular medium, so has to protect his vision, his integrity, and his wellspring by disappearing from the press in order to protect what we want to see, which is really his very deeply internal vision in a popular medium. I think that one of the things that I try to do as a writer, I'm really almost never interested in people who are quote-unquote hot or accessible. I'm interested in the people who are on the margins, who have influenced greatly what we see, think, listen to, without getting the acknowledgement or credit that they should have. People like the late, great Greg Toland, who was the cinematographer on Citizen Kane. There's nothing written about him, for instance. I'd like to write about him one day. I'd love to write about Jane Bowles one day. I'd like to write about Betty Smith, a nearly forgotten novelist who wrote A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, but many other books. I'd love to write about, you know, the influence that Fassbinder's work has had on not only gay cinema, but on acting style of the last 10 years. So there's lots of people that I feel that I spend a large part of my creative day on my knees thanking these other people.
So you have a whole career ahead of you writing about these at least half dozen artists.
Yes, exactly. And your show has prompted me to get it together and do that.
My pleasure. Hilton Ohls, I want to thank you for joining me today in Studio 360.
Well, thank you.
Hilton Ohls writes for The New Yorker. His most recent book is called The Women, and his next book is called The Group, about the intellectual worlds around James Baldwin. For more information about Hilton Ohls and any of the other stories you've heard on our program today, visit our website, studio360.org. To close our show today, we're going to look at a project by the experimental musician Stephen Vitiello. You actually heard from him earlier today in our appreciation of Pauline Oliveros. Stephen Vitiello is an artist who was given a studio on the 91st floor of the World Trade Center in 1999. For 6 months there, he explored the sounds of the building and its surroundings, and he's been working with that sound ever since.
Before I got up there, I had this idea that the windows would open and I would mount microphones outside and always be listening to what was happening. And the big first shock of getting into the studio was that the windows didn't open, that they were very thin, narrow windows looking out, and you could hear nothing. You just heard the cool, kind of cold sound of the ventilators, and you saw all these events that implied sound: airplanes, helicopters, thunder, cars zooming by below your feet, and heard none of it, which made it very flat. So I started looking for ways to amplify that sound and came up to two systems. One was to place contact microphones, very thin microphones, onto the window, using the mixing board and equalization to sort of zoom in on certain frequencies and start to hear what was outside. And it was shocking. I mean, the first thing I ever heard were church bells. And immediately after that, a plane, and then soon probably just the roar of wind. Had this image that, and I've said before, that the mics on the window going into my mixing board, into my headphones, became this kind of stethoscope. And there was this kind of intimacy of sitting up there at night especially and just listening to the vibration of the building and getting to know the building and getting to know this soundscape of New York, which was a very different focus than anybody else in this gigantic, otherwise very imposing building was having. The day after Hurricane Floyd was the most dramatic in many sources, because you could really hear the building swaying. You could hear, this was in 1999, and it was one of the two worst hurricanes to hit New York in the decade, and the building was soaked, and the winds were still really whipping the building back and forth, and you could hear it creaking and almost cracking like an old wooden chip. The second set of experiments I did were with a photocell, and I wanted to find a way to translate the light that I was seeing into sound. Using photocells that are used in light meters, we could actually wire them up to audio cables And when you pointed the photocells at different lights, especially through a telescope so you could get very close, you could actually translate the pulse of the light into a pulse of tone. And so at night I would do experiments and, let's say, zoom in on a police car or someone turning on and off lights in an office building and actually pick up tones. The Colgate clock, the red clock over the Hudson River, had a really beautiful deep tone, and other white lights gave off a kind of flickering white light pulse that became fascinating and source for all sorts of projects I was working on. I was very nervous after the building was destroyed, and the buildings were destroyed, about how to be the most sensitive to the material and how people would respond to it, and felt like I had to wait a little bit, and also understanding this point of view that it was my own experience and own relationship to the building and to the sound of New York, and that it was something I did in 99, I held on to. In a sense, it sort of became more poignant after the buildings were destroyed, but still connected to the work I do in general as an artist.
Stephen Vitiello's recordings from the World Trade Center are currently part of the Whitney Museum's Biennial in New York. Michael Rayfield produced that piece. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Jocelyn Gonzalez,
Steve Nelson,
Michelle Siegel,
Lital Mulad,
Andy Lancet,
Karen Havlick,
Lou Olkowski,
Michael Rayfield.
Our artist interviews were produced by Trey Kay. The music is by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is co-produced by WNYC Radio and Public Radio International, and is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Tiffany & Company Foundation, and the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation.
Miss America Audio, courtesy of the Miss America Organization.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, refusing to turn the other cheek.
And Mingus, he wanted to actually beat Eric up because Eric was going to quit. Mingus threatened him. He wanted to fight him. He wanted to cut him with a knife.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Revenge, from children's books to Charles Mingus, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.